And welcome back to Dr. Drill's Making Motivation podcast, where it is our mission to honor interesting and authentic people by telling their stories. In the process, we hope to inform you, we hope to inspire you, we hope to put a smile on your face and a little fire under your ass. Today, I've got a good friend of mine, Rick Sands, with me. He is an Air Force veteran of the Vietnam era, and he's going to tell us all about that experience, and we're going to laugh and carry on. It's going to be great. How are you doing today, Rick?
I'm doing just fine.
Yeah. Oh, awesome, man. Take it away. Tell your story. How'd you wind up in the Air Force? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Northeast Philadelphia, actually called the Far Northeast, in the Somerton section of Philadelphia, and graduated from George Washington High School in 1967. So at the time, I had no idea what I was doing with my life. I was not ready to go to college. I was just turned 17. I worked at a local drugstore doing prescriptions and delivering prescriptions and things of that nature. So didn't think much of it. My father was very angry at me. So graduate from high school, working at the drugstore is not exactly.
He didn't like that.
Something he's looking for. So he made me take a job with a moving company because he told me if I'm not going to go to college, then you're going to find out what it's like to work for a living. Okay. So I just turned 18 in March of 68. I'm working for this guy's moving company. I hated every day of going to work. I hated it.
Hard work, right?
I'm in great shape, but it was ball busting work. Anyway, of course, 1968 was pretty much the height of the Vietnam War. That's when we had the most troops over there. I believe at the time we had well over half a million troops, and the war was really going full tilt by that time. For 68 was so many things happened in 68. In January, I guess it was, or February, was what they called the Tet Offensive that was happening in Vietnam.
Heard of it, yeah.
And the North Vietnamese started doing offensive against American troops, and they got themselves all the way down to Saigon. So it was, they say the Americans won that battle, but this is when the turning of the war began. April, of course, Martin Luther King was assassinated. June, Robert Kennedy Jr. was assassinated. And by August, there was the Chicago Democratic Convention, which was, it was not going well out there. Vietnam War protesters were out in the streets, clashing with the police, and it was a very, very ugly scene, both outside and inside that convention. Anyway, because now I'm 18 years old, I had gotten my draft notice probably around July or August, I can remember. And I told my father, he says, I don't know what you're going to do, but you better do something. I don't really know what he meant by that, whether he meant for me to hightail it up to Canada or what he meant. But he just meant the wars, it was really going, a lot of GIs were dying. So I thought about it. I'm like, well, why don't I go join the Navy? You know, how I'll go serve on an aircraft carrier. It didn't matter to me.
Sure.
So living in the Northeast, there was a recruiting station at Frankfort and Cotman in the Mayfair section of the city with my intention of joining the Navy. And I went in the front door of a hallway, and the Navy recruiter was to the left, but he had his door shut and he was out to lunch. I looked across the hall. There was the Air Force recruiter sitting at his desk. I shrugged my shoulders and I went inside and I joined the Air Force. But of course, back then, you had to have a high school diploma to get into the Navy or the Air Force. You did not need one for the Army or Marines. It's just the way it was. So I had my big high school diploma, whoopee-doo. So this was around October. I had a delayed enlistment, and I finally left for Shepherd Air Force Base, which is the only basic training site for the Air Force down in San Antonio, Texas. And that was in March of 1969. I really didn't know what I was going to do. The recruiter said, listen, because you take a series of tests in the Air Force to find out what your best aptitude test. And I can tell you, mechanics was not my strong suit, but that's what they gave me. It was pretty much, this is what we got, take it or leave it. Okay. So I trained to remove and replace and to test propellers. That's what they sent me to school for 16 weeks for. It was the second dirtiest job in the Air Force next to hydraulic guys. So after that, I went to, I went to school down Wichita Falls, Texas, and spent the whole summer of 69 there. And then they sent me to Dover Air Force Base down in Delaware. I lucked out. I was sent relatively close to home.
Yeah, it's right down the road.
It was only 2 hours ago. So I went down to, I spent it from around September of 69. And then in May of 70, it was Mother's Day, as a matter of fact, a buddy of mine called me on the phone because he knew I'd come home. He says, I got bad news for you. I'm like, what? What? He says, the orders are up. You're going to Vietnam.
Ah, shit.
So it's Mother's Day. And I didn't want to tell my mother on Mother's Day that I was going to be sent to Vietnam. So I told my father, said, that's a good idea. Don't tell your mother right now. So for the next few months, I was down in Dover. And then by August, I had to leave. So August 1970. Of course, by then, there were more troops coming home from Vietnam who were being sent. But we still went.
Right.
By 70, they had started a troop reduction. And but I still went. And I flew out of McCord Air Force Base out near Seattle, Washington. I can tell you, the day we're loading up the plane, there was another plane of guys, GIs, Air Force, Army. The Air Force and Army always worked, always seemed to be together. It's like the Navy and the Marines.
You're right.
The Army seemed to like to jump out of our airplanes.
Yeah.
So anyway, as we're going towards the plane to go, there was a whole plane empty of the guys that just came back. And they really made fun of us and said a lot of unkind things to us. on the plane. So off I went. Now, I landed in Cameron Bay. Back then the planes made multiple stops, in one in Alaska, Japan, before I got there. And I'll never forget getting off the plane, and it was nighttime, and they load us onto these buses because they were going to take us to these temporary barracks, because the base I was going to go to, I had to take a military flight, and wasn't leaving the next day. When we got on that bus, and the guy said, if you hear explosions, please get down under the seat and cover up. And I'm like, what? Bombs? like, you could die here.
Oh, Lord.
So anyway, so the next day I flew by myself. Well, there's other guys. I didn't know anybody. And if I can backtrack in May of 70 was the tragedy at Kent State.
Yes.
Four students were killed by the National Guard.
That was a war protest?
It was a war protest. They never should have given these National Guard kids, and they were kids, live bullets. They should have been given at least rubber bullets. Of course, a lot of people don't. The reason for Kent State was they were burning the ROTC barracks.
Oh.
So there was a lot going on. I'm not excusing the guys, the four people who died, but they should have closed the campus, and they didn't. They called in the National Guard instead of telling everybody to go home. So I arrived at my air base, Phuket Air Base, in the Central Highlands. And the first thing I noticed were these GIs wearing T-shirts, homemade T-shirts. And the T-shirt said, National Guard 4, Kent State nothing.
Oh, my God.
Yes. It was wow. Of course, by 1970, the war was really unpopular. And I can tell you, from my experience, by then, the war protests were really wearing down on them.
Morale.
A lot of the guys who were there. Sick of seeing them waving the North Vietnamese flag, and I'm one of them. It used to drive me nuts. And we used to think, what are you protesting? You're all safe at home. Don't tell me you're protesting the street for me. If anybody should be protesting, we should be protesting. Now, I know that's a simplistic thing, and that's not really, but it was seeing war protests at home while you were in Vietnam was really unsettling. So
it anyway, sets up the whole us against them thing.
Right? It was us versus against us then. Race issues had really gotten worse because there was race issues at home, and it was no different when we got there. There was a lot of segregation. I don't mean forced segregation, but African Americans stayed with them, and the white soldiers or an airmen stayed with one another, and intermingling was just not what you did.
Right.
I mean, obviously we had to work with one another, but after hours and such. So, Phuket Air Base.
I'm gonna pull up the slides.
Yeah. All right. Not one of the most well-known air bases in Vietnam, and not like Nha Trang or Phang Rang or Cam Ranh Bay or places like that. But it was near the city of Quy Nhon. And there we go.
So this is the geography of let me see if I can eliminate this thing down here. So that's Vietnam, yes?
Yes.
And so where is Phuket?
Phuket is right along the coast, right around in that location. Near this, a larger city called Quy Nhon, Quynhon, I believe.
Can you see my cursor there?
Yep.
Okay.
And so right in that area.
Okay. And then what is this? This is Vietnam over here. My geography sucks.
Right about it was the DMZ, the north. That's North Vietnam up top. Now it's all one country. That was the North Vietnam, and down here. Right where your cursor is with South Vietnam.
Understood.
So.
And this is the air. This is an airfield or the air base.
That's an airfield. Yeah. And at that location, we had what was called C-7A Caribous.
Okay.
They were primarily designed for short takeoff and runways in landing zones. That's an F-4. We had a squadron of F-4s. Yeah, that's the C-7A Caribou. I spent many a time on that. They also were used, unfortunately, for bringing home body bags from the field.
Okay.
And then they were brought back to our base, and then they were flown down to Cam Ranh Bay or Saigon, wherever, for shipment, for shipment home. Very unsettling back in those days. I used to crawl inside those airplanes. Oh, there's Phuket. I don't know what Phuket means, to be honest with you. I never really gave it a thought. I'm sure it stands for something, but I don't know.
Did you have any nicknames for it?
No.
No, really. There wasn't anybody use a derogatory.
C-7A. You can see the that the dirt landing strip. C-130s, we did not have at our base. They used to come in often. And everybody's familiar with the C-130. They carried much more cargo.
Okay.
And, you ever seen video of what happened up at Kaesan? You'll see the C-130s who were bringing in the supplies. So those poor guys up in that, up at Kaesan. So and we had a lot of helicopters. F-4, there was an F-4 fighter squadron.
Is that an F-4 right there?
At that base. And that's a, that's called a, I don't know what that, I forget what that one is. But you had a picture of the F-4. And the Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese, and especially the Viet Cong, were, let me back up a little bit. My very first night at Phu Cat, they put me in a barracks room. And I was all by myself. I didn't know a soul. And about 4 o'clock in the morning, air raid sirens are going off. Flares are going everywhere. And I hear explosions. And I remember looking out the window. It's not really a window. It's just a screen. There was no glass.
Right.
And I saw explosions. And I'm like, wait a minute. I'm Rick Sands from Northeast Philly. this is not really where I want to be. So I literally flew on the floor and pulled the mattress on top of me. And that's what I did. It was a really scary morning for me until all that stopped. And the problem was the North Vietnamese or the Viet Cong, they used to just shoot their mortars from wherever they wanted. And they were not, all they wanted was those airplanes out on the flight deck. Sometimes it didn't go to the flight deck. It landed on the base. So, you know. But the air base itself was, it was almost, listen, everybody hates the Air Force.
We had all, you guys got it so good. You guys are civilized.
We had creature comforts. Eventually I got a roommate. We had a little refrigerator that was a stock of beer and soda and whatever. They called it the stereo war because everybody bought stereos because they were so cheap. Reel-to-reel tape was a big thing back then. But I had my turntable and, you know, I worked 12-hour shifts. You worked either 7 in the morning or 7 at night or 7 at night until 7 in the morning. If you worked the 7 at night till 7 in the morning, not much was happening from, I don't know, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning until the first flights started taking off around 5. So you were bored. You played a lot of card games. And sometimes we'd take a ride out in the flight line in the dark, and we'd climb up into the cockpit of one of those C-7As or the C-47 gunships, and we'd sit in the pilot seat, the co-pilot seat, and we would smoke Mother Nature. It looked like Cheech and Chong. You would see the smoke from the marijuana coming out the sides of the plane. But it's what she did. You know,
pretty benign.
Some guys got much more involved in the heavier drugs. Unfortunately, I never did. But the
glad
marijuana was very, very prevalent.
And they depict that well. It's always part of the cinematic portrayal of Vietnam.
Yes,
the experiences.
Very is much best. So. But anyway, as far as the base, we had a barracks with room and indoor plumbing. Well, it was relatively indoor plumbing. We didn't have this. They weren't outhouses or, you know what I mean. We had a swimming pool.
You had a friggin' swimming pool?
We certainly did. air-conditioned dining hall. There was an air-conditioned NCO club. There was exercise rooms. They had a softball field. There was a driving range for golf balls. That was mostly for the officers. We had a movie theater.
Wow.
So we'd be sitting by the pool. And these poor guys from the 82nd Airborne surrounded us. These poor guys have been out in the bush for, you know, a month, no bath. You know what I mean? And they would come onto the base to go to the BX. to buy cigarettes and beer or whatever else they needed to buy, and they'd be walking past us and we're sitting at the pool having a cold one. What can I tell you? It is what it was. That's why everybody hated the Air Force. The Army hated us, and we used to say the Marines didn't even acknowledge our existence. Although we didn't see very many Marines, most Marines were located far north. We saw very little Navy because most of the Navy guys were down along the Delta in their riverboats that they would in. So it was mostly Army and Air Force from roughly Saigon up to near Da Nang. So,
Tell me about Rick. Tell me about some of your buddies, the guys you served with.
Who was when I was there, of course, it's been a long time since I've seen him. My roommate was from a little town called Henderson, Kentucky. Another roommate was from North Carolina. And I had an Hispanic guy. He was from California. So we lived together. We were all there about the same time, more or less. We got there within a month or two. And we hung out. Played cards, drank, smoked pot, played cards, listened to music. You know, you went to breakfast or dinner together, depending on what you did. My roommate from Kentucky, we went to breakfast one morning, and I got what I thought was cream of wheat. And I'm putting milk and sugar on my cream of wheat. And his name is Dave Rideout. He says to me, "Yankee, what in the hell are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm putting milk and sugar on my cream of wheat." He says, "That ain't cream of wheat. Them's grits. You put butter and salt and pepper." I'm like, I never had grits before. I had no idea what grits were.
Yeah, I'm a Yankee too. I always like brown sugar on mine, you know.
So, you know, that's so I was there for 11 months and 29 days. I used to know the hours and minutes too, but it was okay. The guys from Vietnam who were combat, I had an entirely different experience of. And I can't relate to them because I wasn't out in the bush. I didn't fire a gun. I carried a tool bag. Somebody needed to fix the planes. So that's what I did.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. You know, and that's, we spoke about this a little bit before we went on air, and I feel this way too sometimes. Rick, it's, you know, I served in, for 4 years in peacetime. You know, it was like right before the shit hit the fan with, the global war on terror and all that stuff. Right. But you know, we trained our asses off. We deployed, you know, all over the place and did training and had liberty, you know, saw some cool places, but I did not have a combat experience. And although I trained very hard for that contingency, I'm pleased that I did not have, you know, kill or be killed. You know, I was prepared to do that stuff, but, you spoke to, all the infrastructure that's around the military services. Like a very small percentage of people. I forget what the math is on it, but it's very, very minuscule number of individuals, percentage of those who are actively serving, who are actually putting rounds down range. You know, but everybody.
You need a lot of support people behind that. There are guys who work that the Phuket building, all of that was where all our records were kept.
Yeah.
Reports were done and all the other things that they had there. My worst, I can tell you this. I lost track, by the way, of those guys from Vietnam, because in the Air Force, unlike the Army and even the Marines, you went to Vietnam, you came home. And you went from combat to home. And that's why there's a lot of guys who came back with a lot of issues. I, on the other hand, had another year and a half to go. So I transitioned. I'll tell you about that. I meant to, for a year and a half in North Carolina before I was discharged. And that's what happened. They sent us all, everybody went all over the place. But my worst experience when I was in Vietnam, you were permitted about to leave to go down to Cam Ranh Bay, which was the departure place for a lot of guys, 3 days before your actual leave date. You could go down there and and relax and go to the beach and so forth and so on. Anyway, we had a softball tournament. I was not in the squadron I was in, we were out. And we knew these guys, there were three of them, and they were still playing, and they wanted to hang for another day or two to finish playing in the softball tournament. Fine, except one day, they're playing. They came to the base, they said goodbye to us, and they were going across the street to the terminal, which was really nothing more than a Kwanzaa hut. And we watched our military plane land, and it landed, and it made its taxiway, and it was coming back towards the Quonset hut, and a rocket hit the Quonset hut and killed all three of them.
Oh, shit.
They were maybe a half hour from going home. I can't imagine that call to their parents or their wives or whoever it was at home for them to find out. They had about 30 more minutes and they would have been safely on their way. So it was my turn to go home. I went to 3 days. I didn't hang. Just get me out of here. I want to go. So that's what I did. But that was very traumatic because we were staying outside when that rocket hit. And we didn't think of it at the time until we realized. And then all of a sudden, you know, it went off and there was an explosion and all hell broke loose.
So, I guess so. What now? Who provided security for the Air Force bases?
The 82nd Airborne, and they called themselves the ROC Marines. ROC, ROK, for Republic of Korea.
Yeah, I mean,
they were badass.
Yeah,
they were not tied to the constraints of the war. They had all these stupid rules of fire free zones, or you couldn't fire because of this. The war wasn't fought properly. I know some people think we shouldn't have been there at all, and that's fine. But had it been fought properly, it would have, this wouldn't have gone on for 10 years. Anyway, it was all about politics. The Marines, the ROC Marines, were not tied to that. If they got bombed, they went out into the jungle and they killed as many, and they wouldn't come back, and they killed as many North Vietnamese or Viet Cong as they could. And then they would have weapons displays. And this is gross, but they used to cut off their ears of the dead North Vietnamese or Viet Cong, and they used to display it. So
that's for real. That's not just lore. That's real.
No, that is absolutely real. But the ROC Marines, they were nice guys, and you know, it was fine to speak English, but a lot of people didn't realize that the Republic of Korea served in Vietnam, as did the Australians. We used to run into a lot of Aussies. But anyway, so it was the 82nd Airborne, and the Air Force had its own. They really did. They had their own perimeter guards, and they were combat. They carried guns, and they shot, and so forth, and so on. But it was mostly the 82nd Airborne and the ROC Marines. So
they were providing security while you guys were running the operation, making sure the planes.
Correct.
Were...
Yep. Yep. And it was a pretty, you said planes from all over, helicopters, you name it. The Army was always there. The Army was always coming in and coming out. Like I said, they'd like to ride in our airplanes. I can tell you the F-4 Phantom jets used to take off. And of course, they would take off in almost an entire squadron, one after the other, after the other, after the other. And it was quite an impressive sight. And they're... job was to go up into the mountains because we were surrounded by mountains and they were carrying the napalm. Thank God the enemy didn't have the napalm, because they would strafe those mountainsides and the explosion and the balls of fire that ran down the side of the mountains, especially at nighttime. And of course the tracer bullets that used to come from them also. The C-130s we did not have, but we used to see them all the time. They were the gunships. It escapes me now what we used to call them. I'm sure there's some Vietnam veterans out there going, oh, come on, you know what the name of them were. But they had these 20 caliber machine guns and such sticking out the sides. And they'd also be shooting those things at nighttime at the enemy. So, you know, it was war.
Now you're seeing this. You're seeing this. You can see this from the base. This is visible.
Oh, yeah. They lighten up the. Away. Oh, yeah. And then, of course, the other one was the B-52s. You never saw them. But you heard the bombs, and you would see them strafe out in the distance, and that's what they would do. They would just drop. Everybody's seen the pictures of B-52s dropping their bombs. That was a lot of bombs.
Yeah.
And, I just on a side note, this is one of the things that used to irritate me about Vietnam. Is we had all this equipment, all these planes, tanks, best equipped armies and Marines in the world. It took us 10 years and we still didn't win. The Viet Cong didn't have an Air Force. I think North Vietnamese had, but certainly didn't compare to the U.S. Air Force or the Navy. Because the Navy also flew in from their ships, or the Marines also had F-4s, but we had all this massive equipment and weapons of mass destruction. But we just couldn't win. So, which brings me, because of Jungle Cover, Agent Orange.
Mm-hmm.
For those who were in Vietnam, we all know what Agent Orange was. For those who don't, it was a defoliant made by Dow Chemical Company. And it was used and sprayed on the jungle. It was like a weed killer to take away the canopy of the jungle, which is what the enemy used to, you know, to maneuver through. Some of these planes, a C-120, some of these guys would be on the back of these planes with 55-gallon drums with high-powered nozzles, and they would stand at the back of the plane with the cargo cargo gate down, and they'd be shooting. Now, those planes here that we see, those were also used. They did get away with the guy standing. I mean, you can imagine they're shooting this stuff out from the back of a plane. Well, a lot of it washed right back into the plane again. Oof. It was all over the place. So the planes you see there, you can see they were used, that they were the tanks that were used, and they sprayed that defoliant. And hey, there were soldiers down there. There were guys down there, and it went all over the place. I was affected by Agent Orange. I had prostate cancer. And which is one of the side products, side issues of, we used to see them spray that stuff. We thought they were spraying for mosquitoes. Nobody ever told us what it was for. We thought they were killing bugs. And I lost my prostate due to prostate cancer. I also lost my kidney at the same time due to cancer, but the Veterans Administration does not acknowledge kidney cancer as a product of Agent Orange. That's fine. We try, and they my urologist even sent a letter. But regardless, I do get a disability payment. So
good.
Anyway, that Agent Orange was nasty stuff. And I used to climb inside planes all the time. You had to go through the plane to go up to do operational checks on the engines and the propellers. So, you know, I used to breathe it always, you know.
Did it have a distinct smell?
No. Didn't smell anything.
Yeah,
it was invisible. You didn't really see it.
Was it an effective exfoliant?
Yeah, it is.
It took the leaves dropped off and all that shit?
Yeah, we killed entire sections of the jungle, but the jungle has a funny way of always growing back.
So it's not a permanent environmental.
I don't believe it's a permanent thing. Otherwise, they would have sprayed everywhere with it. But
yeah.
So
what?
So anyway, I spent my year there. Monsoon season was the worst, where it would just rain for days and days and days and days. And you had no glass on your barracks. You couldn't have glass in buildings, obviously, for explosions with the glass. So you just had screening. And during monsoon, it was wet. It was always damp. don't want anybody to feel sorry for us, that my sheets were damp and your clothes were damp and you had guys who were sitting out there in a jungle who were soaked and sat in that crap for days upon days upon days. At least I could go up and get a hot meal at the chow hall.
Right.
You know, it's boring because nothing went on. He didn't get any mail because the rains would come down so hard. And so we at least had to try to do something. But my worst was Christmas Eve, 1970. It was raining so hard. And it was the worst night of all the nights I was there. So anyway, in August of 1971, I went in August of 70, served 11 months, 29 days. I got my new orders. I don't know, I guess it was in June or July of 71 that I was to report to Pope Air Force Base down in Fayetteville, Spring Lake, North Carolina. And Pope was there primarily as a air base to serve Fort Bragg. Again, that's what the Air Force did. It provided the Army. Just like McGuire was over here for Fort Dix and countless other air bases. McCord Air Force Base in Washington State for Fort Lewis and so forth and so on.
Yeah.
So in August of 60 or August of 71, it was time for me to go home. And I flew down to Cameron Bay and they put us in what they called as the DC Stretch 8. It was a monstrous plane. I think it held about 250, 260 people. And it was all GIs. It was all Army and Air Force. And when that plane took off, we used to call them Freedom Birds. It was a madhouse in the plane. We really felt sorry for some of the back then they were stewardesses, now they're flight attendants, but back then they were stewardesses. So on the way back, we flew to Japan and landed in Anchorage, Alaska. And then we flew into, we actually went to SeaTac, Seattle Tacoma International Airport, and they let us off when I was getting ready to. I had a flight to catch my way back to Philadelphia. And as we deplaned, now keep in mind, the 82nd Airborne with us, and they had only been out in that jungle maybe a week earlier. And we were greeted by hippies, and they were chanting baby killers at us. It was not advisable. But a lot of these guys were not in the mood to listen to these people chant baby killers at us, but that's what they did. There was a terrible fight. Like I said, these guys in ASIC were in no mood for this, and they were beating the hell out of these hippies. Personally, I just wanted to go home. It irritated me. I wasn't going to get involved in a fist fight and so forth with guys from the 82nd Airborne. Most of the Air Force guys, like, okay, we'll see you now. We're going home because here comes the MPs and here come the security police and here comes the Air Force or the airport security and Seattle police. It was an ugly, ugly scene. But those are one of the things that affected me the most was the chance of baby killers. To this day, I find those people deplorable.
Yeah. So, well, I just queued up Fortunate Son here. That is another one of the things that I really enjoy talking about Rick is that Rick has an encyclopedic knowledge of classic rock and roll. Oh, yeah. particularly about he knows who was in the band, what year they more formed less, this. Yeah. Yeah. So obviously, you know, some people are just really good at that, but I imagine, and when I think about my soundtrack, what I'm always trying to listen to, classic rock and roll, I grew up on that, so we're always rocking out to that in the office here, but there's something about that time, 60s and early 70s, where the music, there was a cultural revolution, there's a war,
drugs,
the human rights stuff, and the racial issues, drugs, there's a cultural and a musical revolution. So I've been wondering why there's not like we haven't had like a mutual revolution recently, because we always think about being in the time, you know, in the current day, we're thinking about all the crazy stuff that you see on the news. So you're trying to tell me that it was always like that?
You know, I can tell you, like, this is one of the things that just during the Iran-Afghanistan war, if you notice, there was never really any protests. And that lasted, what, 10 years? There was never any protests by anybody. And why was that? Because there's no draft. They weren't protesting so much the war back in the 60s as they were protesting the draft. I get pictures of guys holding draft, burning their draft card, and so forth and so on. It's an all-volunteer force now. If you want to serve, fine. If you don't want to serve, fine. But back when I was in, you either ran away or you served in the military unless you were, you know, not qualified to be in. So, yeah, the music, because I was 14 when the Beatles first appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show. So that was, it's always been amazing to me how things change so quickly. I grew up in the 50s into the early 60s. It was a relatively innocent time. I always say I miss the Eisenhower administration only because being a kid in the 50s, trying to explain to anybody today what it was like, you can't. I guess it'd be like my parents try to explain to me what it was like to live during a depression. I didn't have a care in the world. I live in a nice, safe street. You came home, and mom told you'd be home for dinner. You could be going all day. Nobody had cell phones or all the other things going on with it. Kennedy was shot in November of 63. It went all to hell not long after that. 2 months later, the Beatles appeared on Ed Sullivan. Here comes the British invasion. Here comes all the civil rights marches in Washington. And then it started getting to the, the anti-war protest songs. One of the biggest songs of the era was Buffalo Springfield's For What It's Worth. Something's happening here, what it is, ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. And that was just epitomizes what was happening. Yeah. You had all the race riots in Detroit and Los Angeles and so forth. So in a very short period of time, all hell broke loose. And the whole cultural upheaval that was going on was it was just amazing to me, and how the music went from Leslie Gore or Neil Sedaka. So now you had Vanilla Fudge and Cream and Jimi Hendrix, and you had Motown came into being, and so all the things changed so quickly. It was just always amazing to me in that short period of time. You had Gary Lewis and Playboys. Next thing you know, you're listening to Led Zeppelin. It was just amazing, and I listened to all that music.
So how does that shake out, though? Because a lot of the, I just played Fortunate Son by Creedence. So if we can back that into your story, the draft was going on. First of all, you think that there should still be a draft?
I believe that everybody should serve. And this may be a little controversial, but in all the name of women's rights, and they all want equality, and that's all fine and good, women should be subject then to the draft. You can't. Oh, no, only men are going to be drafted. Well, wait a minute. You wanted equality. You wanted to be on the same equal. That's fine. Then you should also be subject to the draft. It would never happen. They would never bring back the draft, I don't think. I don't know what politician would even attempt to do that.
Well, so, it's like he says in the song, you know, some folks are born silver spoon in hand. Yes, and so... True. You know,
if you had the money and you had the lawyers and you had everything else, you didn't have to go. And of course, one thing that irritated was the kids who went to college didn't have to serve.
Right.
So it was only, poor white kids from Appalachia or inner city black kids from New York and Chicago and so forth, or you didn't even finish high school. And that's who. Yeah, that's who served. They're the guys who gave up their lives. And I'm sure there were guys who went to college and also volunteered to go, but that's a very small percentage.
Yeah. Well, it also, it leaves one feeling like, yeah, you go to college and then your perspective, you have zero actual perspective on it. You're not on the boot. You don't have your boots on the ground. You're not feeling, you know, I mean, war is hell, right or wrong. I mean, I always felt, you know, I've been talking to my fellow servicemen and women about the that when you're young and you join the military, you're on an adventure, you're not risk averse. So you're wanting to go out there and have an experience, have an adventure, kick ass. And so you don't really think about the political aspects of these things now.
Right.
But do you, how do you feel about, you know, the Vietnam War now?
It was a waste of 56,000 lives, basically, roughly. That's how many guys gave up their life in Vietnam. Again, because it wasn't fought correctly. Either fight the damn war, and this is the United States of America, the most powerful country, and we could not beat literally a ragtag bunch of Viet Cong soldiers in straw hats and black pajamas. And yes, there was a North Vietnamese army. We should have destroyed North Vietnam, if that's what you're going to do. Just obliterate it, end of problem. But we pussyfooted around, and we dragged it on, and dragged it on, and dragged it on, and dragged it on. Like I said, I was there. You couldn't fight the war correctly. It was just nonsense of what you could and what you couldn't do. You can't fight today because they're in a freeze zone. I never understood what that was. An enemy could be out there, but you were not allowed to go get them because of some political BS. And that's why it took us 10 years or more to fight the thing. Either fight it right or go home. Just pick up everybody. I understand what the original intent was. And, you know, everybody can second guess it now. But because of what was happening with the communists after World War II, with Russia and China, they were scared to death that communism was going to spread throughout the entire Southeast and beyond. And the United States government said, we can't have that. We got to put a stop to this now. And in the end, it didn't matter. Whereas now, if you look at Vietnam, it's communist, but it's very modern.
Yeah, it's a great place to go on vacation.
They've taken all the trappings of capitalism and rolled it into a communist country. What happened? Same thing with China. Last thing I remember with China, they're running around with little red books singing the praises of Mao Zedong. And now you see China with gleaming skyscrapers, and we buy everything. For everything we buy now comes from China. And it's just an amazing transformation. So anyway, I understand what the intent was. It didn't work. It just didn't, just doesn't work. We stopped the Cubans, the Russians, for putting those missiles down in Cuba. And because Kennedy said, you're not going to do this because bad things are going to happen. And they backed off. Whether that would have happened with China and or North Vietnam, I don't know. But we pussyfooted around and we got ourselves in a mess. By the way, of course, Woodstock happened while I was in the Air Force. And if everybody's familiar with the Fish Chair, because that was out in late August of 69, I was still in Texas, and by 1970, the album was out. And every time we would come under a rocket attack, somebody would turn on their turntable and they would blast the Fish Chair. Come along, you big, strong men. Uncle Sam needs your help again. And we sang it very loudly because we got ourselves in a terrible jam. So
how did you feel? This it?
Give me an F.
Yeah.
Give me a U.
Yeah.
Give me a C.
Yeah.
Give me a K.
Yeah.
What's that spell?
Yeah.
What's that spell?
Yeah.
What's that spell?
Yeah.
That was the studio version. The more famous one was when he sang that in front of like 500,000 people at Woodstock, but it was the same effect. So
what do you think about, I mean, how do you feel with, when you got the turntable going and the music that you appreciate so much is coming on? Some of the lyrics, were any of the artists kind of off limits because of the nature of their lyrics, or did you embrace all that and just kind of,
most of it I just viewed as music. I didn't have to agree with, you know, with every song that came out. Some they just sang along with, you know, White Rabbit, as you played originally, was obviously a drug song, and they do drugs. It's got marijuana, but I'm talking about drugs. The Buffalo Springfield, For What It's Worth. It was anti whatever, but I never had a problem. I think it's one of the classic songs of the 1960s. So off the top of my head, there was really nothing that I can think that was terribly offensive. The only offensive thing I found about Vietnam was Jane Fonda. You won't find a Vietnam veteran alive who doesn't detest Jane Fonda. To this day, I will never watch any of her movies. I will never acknowledge anything. I find her to be a traitor. For those who don't know, there's the famous picture, I guess it was 1972, where she went to North Vietnam, and she's pictured sitting with smiling North Vietnamese soldiers wearing a helmet behind an anti-aircraft gun. And she thought that was really cool. And then she disparaged the POWs who were there and claimed, you know, they were well taken care of. She was sickening. And she really never really apologized for it, for all her anti-war and anti-establishment rhetoric. I always found it interesting that she ended up marrying Ted Turner, one of the biggest capitalists in the country, but whatever. Yeah, you can go to most VFW halls and you'll find pictures of Hanoi Jane in the urinals. That's just the way it is. Hanoi Jane was her name. That's what everybody still calls her. And when she dies, there won't be a 21-gun salute. So
that's for sure.
So she's my only really holdover from them. I was a believer, and again, many people will disagree, and that is fine. But I actually believe that the war protests actually helped prolong the war. It did not shorten the war, because it was used as propaganda. And to see Americans, especially these college kids, sort of like what's happening today, even waving the enemy flag while GIs were dying, I find just appalling.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have seen Americans waving a Nazi flag during World War II. You just don't do that. You can be against the war. I don't have a problem with that. Now, that's perfectly acceptable. But you're aiding and abetting the enemy. And that's just where I thought, and it really changed my political thinking since then. So real quick, I can tell you I voted in 1972, at the very first presidential election. Now they had changed it to 18 to vote, which was another appalling thing, that you could serve your country and die for your country, but you couldn't vote because you were only 18. So that was necessary to change. Went on the back of my car. I had a sticker, and it was a bunch of little peace signs, and it said footprint of the American chicken. Again, I'm not trying to get, that's just how it was back then. You would have been a hippie, and I understand about the peace symbol, but being in the military, you generally have a different way of thinking, and that was my feeling at the time. So
right. So when you come back now, we touched on this a little bit before we started rolling there, Rick. Your brother, who we're gonna try to convince to get in the podcast. Yeah. I've met him; he's a real interesting guy. So he's back home. The Tale of Two Brothers, the Sands brothers. Tell me about.
Yeah, I wish I had a picture. I have it somewhere. The day I came home from Vietnam, my brother was quote unquote hippie. He actually graduated from high school in 1971. He avoided the draft, although I told him countless times by 1971, you weren't going to go to Vietnam, because it wasn't much longer than we had massive pullouts, but whatever. So the day I came home, you know, I weighed about 70 pounds, less than I do now, in my Air Force uniform with my real short hair, standing next to my brother. He's got well below his shoulder length hair with the mustache and everything else, and was standing next to one another. And it is a true contrast of the differences that were taking place at that time. Was, you know, he's all peace symbol, and I was not all about the peace symbol.
So, you had a different perspective. That's what I mean. It'd be great to hear, you know, to hear his perspective, his point of view on it as relation, like when you come home, like when you're out there serving, I wonder. So we're going to try to get that rascal on the podcast. Yeah,
I will try. If you do, I will give him, he's well familiar with that picture. I will see if I can dig that up, because it's just a classic example of what was happening at the time. So anyway, I spent my last year and a half in the Air Force, and then I got discharged in March of 73. So I did my 3 years and 11 months and so many days of being in the service. And that was the other side of it. If you went in the Army or the Marines in the draft, by the way, the Marines did draft. People think only the Army. The day I went down to 401 North Broad is where you entered. They had a big cavernous room and said Navy, Air Force, Army. There was no sign for Marine Corps. So these guys, well, maybe there was, but there wasn't. It was a very small section. So they would get I'm sitting there, and this Marine drill instructor, I guess, came over to all these guys and said, "All you guys line up," and they line up against the wall, told them to count off. All right, all you who were even number or odd, I don't remember which, you're now members, you're now in the United States Marine Corps. And these guys went, "I didn't join the Marine Corps. I thought I was being drafted into the Army." Because Marines did not draft. They didn't. There was no draft into the Marines. You were drafted into the Army, but the Marine Corps needed to stock up. So they... So they took those guys, and now the Marine Corps, once you're United States, you know, the military, they can tell you what, you know, where you're going to go. So
that's kind of a shit deal right here. Yeah, you think you're thinking like, you know, you're thinking like, all right, I'm going to hedge my bets, and I'm going to, you know, the Army. Okay. The Army is big service. Yeah. A lot of things I can do in the Army. Yeah. In the Marine Corps, going to Vietnam, who knows? Yeah. They're going to sleeping on the ground for again.
Yeah, a lot of my politics were foreign because of the war. Just the way it was. I was never really political. And then once I came home for that and saw all the crap that was happening, my politics began to change. So, you know.
Yeah. I think everybody, because you had skin in the game, like you can remember that. Yeah. I mean, it definitely colors everything that occurs after life, even if you served in peacetime or.
Right. It's just like it just happened on the news a few days ago. It infuriates me. I don't know whether these protests that are going on. These people are burning the American flag and chanting "Death to America." I'm like, I what is that? I just can't wrap my head. You know, you're free to protest. I don't have a problem with that. But yeah. "Death to America." I'm not some super patriot, but you live here, and I really don't know of too many places that are better than here. And I just can't wrap my head. That's what they used to do during the Vietnam War, burning the American flag. You have a constitutional right to do it, but I find it to be wrong. There's lots of ways to protest. I have no objection to anybody protesting anything. I like to protest how many taxes I pay out here. So,
yeah, no, big time, brother. Cool. Well, I got to tell you there, Rick, that was awesome. Took us on a wild ride through the Vietnam wilderness there. And I appreciate your service. I thank you for your service. And I thank you for sharing some time with me.
I appreciate people do come up to me and are always thanking for my service, because I always find, which is fine. But I always think back about the day I arrived at that airport and they were chanting "baby killers" at us. Nobody gave a rat's ass that we were coming home from Vietnam. just weren't. Nobody cared. As a matter of fact, real quickly, I can tell you the VFW, you go and join the VFW if you were a Vietnam veteran, because they didn't regard it as my father, who was an old World War II. That's not a real war. Like, guys are dying in real time. You know what I mean? You still had death due to a war. It wasn't World War II. I know all about the honor of World War II and so forth, but they didn't regard it as a real war. So it took a long time for Korean veterans to get recognized, because it was the same thing. It was a police action, but yet thousands of guys died. So,
yeah,
but that has all changed.
Yeah, veterans of different conflicts and wars. I mean, certainly, I know that you and I might have had a conversation about this. That Vietnam veterans don't quite feel, or for a long time they didn't quite feel,
correct,
as that their experience was similar to. Obviously, it was different.
Yes.
War, but I mean, World War II, they're still making movies about World War II.
They are.
Really? You know, Vietnam always gets, I mean, they've done some great films about that.
Yeah, like Platoon is one of my favorite Vietnam War, and it's how different it is than seeing, say, Saving Private Ryan. The heroic landing craft coming up on Normandy Beach, and the thing, and it's storming the beach, is just more exciting than seeing a bunch of American GIs in the jungle shooting that into the jungle with people they can't even see. The whole thing is just completely different.
Yeah, yeah.
So everybody during World War II was behind the war, and obviously not everybody was behind the Vietnam War. So that was the difference between the two. So.
Yeah, very interesting, man. Cool. Work on your brother, man. We'll try to get him on the podcast.
Yeah, well, he'll give you a whole different way of looking at things. So I will try my best to. You won't be able to shut him up.
But, once we get him on here, I think it might be difficult.
If I talk to him right, I think he will, because he loves to talk about history and talk about all the changes. And he's a few years younger than I am, but his experiences were completely different than mine were. I mean, he lived in San Francisco at Haight Ashbury, and he was a true hippie and so forth and so on. So just completely different. Yep.
That'd be great, especially in contrast to your experience.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You guys ever go lock horns about it?
Oh, no, not really. He understands that, you know, my experience was different than his. He got drafted and took off. They came looking for, I don't want to get into all that, but they came to my father's house looking for my brother.
Yeah. Because I had an uncle.
Who was... Of course, a lot of guys went to Canada. Hey, that's where you want to go. That's fine. I understand. Well, I sort of understand. I had to go. I went to service. Somebody had to do it.
Right. Yeah.
Yep.
That's awesome. All right. You work on him there, Rick.
I will.
I appreciate your time, Airman. Yeah. This is a time well spent. Love and respect. I'll see you later in the week.
Thank you.
Take care, brother.
Right. Bye.